You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Oles. Tonight on Right on Radio, Dave talks with Thomas D. Peacock, author of The Wolf's Trail, an Ojibwe story told by wolves, from Holy Cow Press in Duluth. He is the author and co-author of a number of books, including two Minnesota Book Award winners. The Seventh Generation, a multicultural children's book, was named Multicultural Children's Book of the Year by the American Association of Multicultural Education. He is a member of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Anishinaabe Ojibwe.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, I'll be chatting with Juan Manuel Munoz, author of From Primates to Politicians. Primates to Politicians is a fascinating journey between the animal side of the human species and politicians. It explores the reasons for many human behaviors based on the evolution of species and the resources necessary for life. Munoz is a physician and political scientist who lives in Panama. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. Okay, Dave?
Yes,
okay.
Hello.
My mistake. You are on the air. My apologies, gentlemen.
Not at all. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Liz. In the studio, Thomas, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. And it's election night in America, but we're going to do something even better than talk about that. We're going to talk about your book, which is a marvel, Thomas. Congratulations on the book and on your amazing career. It's really quite impressive. So, Thomas, let's begin. The title of the book is The Wolf's Trail, an Ojibwe story told by wolves. So let's begin with the inspiration for this story, if we could, Thomas. Where did you come up with this idea that you're going to tell this sort of parallel story? It's a story about the Ojibwe, but it's a story about wolves. And how'd you come up with this?
Well, the Anishinaabe Ojibwe, we have a part of our creation story. And so the idea sort of was born in from our creation story, and I can tell part of it. You know, after the earth was made, the creator sent first human out into the world to name everything on earth. And after a while, the first human noticed that most things were either in flocks or in groups or in pairs, and felt lonesome and asked the creator for someone to go along with them to help do this work of naming the earth. And the creator sent Mainga and sent Wolf. So they went out and they named everything on earth, and that's so the idea for the story was born from that. But what happened after everything was named was both first human and Mayingan were brought before the creator again, and the creator told them certain things, and one of the things that the creator said was that whatever happened to one would happen to the other, and that they would part. So that's that parallel story. And it also said that in honor of that work that the wolf did, that the face of Lake Superior, the Lake Superior would be in the face of a wolf. So we see that today. So the idea of the story was born from that. And then I sort of built on that because wolves have remained wolves, of course, and their culture has remained strong. And as Ojibwe people, we wrestle with colonization and results of colonization. And so we've changed a lot. And wolves, of course, worry because of that parallel story. They worry what's happening with us. And so I built the story from there, and that's the idea of it.
Well, thank you for that. I'm really glad you talked about the creation story. I was really taken by that. I was not familiar with this particular one, and this idea of wolves sort of telling their stories to themselves, but also in partnership with the Ojibwe was fascinating. And you introduced a lot of themes in your answer there, Thomas, that I was going to get to later, but let's just jump right in. First of all, let's talk about wolf culture as you describe it. Did you do a lot of research to, you know, understand how, you know, the alpha, beta, omega, the way wolves hunt, or is this just sort of knowledge you've accrued over time? Because you've done a lot of historical writing yourself.
Yeah, with this particular story, I didn't know an awful lot about wolf social behavior, so I had to do quite a bit of reading, and so I did as much reading as I could, and I watched a bunch of videos. And, you know, it's impossible, of course, to capture, you know, wolf social behavior when you give animals some human voice, intention, yeah, emotions, that kind of thing. But as much as I could, and then once I had a manuscript done, I brought it to the wildlife biologist for, you know, in my reservation in Fond du Lac, mm-hmm, Mike Schraz, and I asked him if he would take the time and read over a rough draft of it and tell me where I was really off, you know,
right,
wolf behavior. And he helped me out at just an awful lot. I mean, it just as an example, in part of the story, Jiche, you know, the elder uncle and the two pups, youngest nephew and little niece, they're on this journey, and mm-hmm, and they have to cross make a crossing of a river, and initially I had them crossing a bridge in the middle of the night, and the Mike Schraz, the wildlife biologist, you know, when he reviewed it, he said wolves would never ever cross a bridge. They'll swim that river. They would never ever walk across a bridge.
Fascinating.
So a lot of little things like that he corrected.
Yeah.
And so that was really helpful.
So listeners are already getting a sense that there's a lot going on in this relatively short book, I will say, well under 200 pages. We get this parallel story of wolves and the Ojibwe. There's history in here. There's just a lot happening and a lot to pick up, and especially someone from, you know, my point of view, a non-native point of view. I found it very eye-opening and beautifully written also, Thomas. And I hope you have an excerpt you're going to read for us in a moment here. But before you do, let's talk a little bit more about wolves. So did you, when you had the wolves speak and communicate, did you try to bring in a sort of wolf idiom, if you will? And then a second question along with that is, there's humor in this story. There's humor between the wolves and the characters, especially the uncle and the younger ones, the storyteller. Is that a reflection of you, Thomas?
What I do with quite a bit of my writing, and it really came out in this one, just like, you know, other works of fiction that I've done, is I write the way that I speak.
Okay.
And I use res talk.
Okay. Yeah.
So the wolves are really doing in a res lingo.
Yeah.
And also that kind of survival humor that we have.
Sure.
So, you know, we call it res humor, and it's pretty dark. And you know, the topic, some of the things in the story, of course, are you know, are emotional, deeply emotional, and sort of mix that in with humor to lighten it up, to make it a little easier to deal with. So yeah, I did throw in that, and it just sort of comes out as I was doing the writing, and I just kept it there, I guess.
So there are some. Very good. There are some, as you said, very emotional, sort of dark or heavy passages, and I want to talk about those too. Before I have you read, one more question, I promise. I love the phrase, Thomas, talking story. The uncle wolf is going to talk story to the nephews. Is that a, where does that come from? Is that a, you know, I think as you described it, reservation phrase, or is that something you pulled out of your hat?
It's not really anything that I pulled out of my hat. There are quite a number of indigenous cultures around the world that use that English speak story, and actually got it from, actually got that particular phrase from a Native Hawaiian friend who uses it all the time, and I just started using it, and then when I started writing this particular story, it's something that I use all the time now, and I noticed Native people are beginning to use. So, yeah, well, it fits perfectly. So
I love it. I would love to be able to borrow it. It's really great. So when you say talking story, Thomas, what do you mean by that?
Talk story is that to me, it's that old part of our oral tradition. You know, a long time ago when people would sit around in winter camp and, mm-hmm. and story, you know, it was done with everything. It includes everything. It includes the, not just the telling of the story, but the pauses and the cadence, the fire, everything that's going on is all part of that. So it's the wholeness, if you can think of it that way.
Yeah.
Being part of it. So that's the way that I think of it when I think talk story.
I love the phrase. It's fantastic. Do you have a reading for us, Thomas?
I do have something. Yeah. And maybe if I could just for a minute, just set it up.
Well, please. That's great.
In part of the story, Auntie Una is talking to the pups. And it's part of a chapter on the sixth fire, and the sixth fire, of course, is one of our prophecies when we go through this very, very difficult period, and it's a part of where we are now as Ojibwe people. We're somewhere in that sixth fire, anyway, she's talking story to the and telling what happened to wolves. She looked around where they were all sitting. "Right here, this is what they call Minnesota," she replied. "We are the few who are left," she said. "There are just a few of us left?" asked a voice from somewhere in the huddle. "Auntie, could I sit up closer to you?" asked another voice from the huddle. "Me too, Auntie," a chorus of more voices joined in. "Come here, all of you," she said softly. All of the pups gathered in close to her. I watched them from a distance, their auntie soothing them, assuring they were protected, loved. Several pups burrowed their faces deep into her fur as they listened to her talk story. "The new humans are bad, aren't they, Auntie Ona?" asked younger nephew. She began licking his face and ears, hesitating for what seemed like the longest time. Then she moved on to another pup, then another. Even the one who always says the word stupid, for he was the one who was closest to her, the one burrowed the deepest into her fur with his snout. Then she answered, "No, they aren't bad. It wasn't all of them who did this. Only a few, only those who believed all the bad stories they heard about us. Many of them tried to live their values. Their teachings on how to live their lives in balance are a lot like ours. Theirs were scratched onto rocks using different words. They call their seven grandfathers angels, their teachings commandments. They scratched on paper this thing made from the meat of trees, the whole story of the Creator's lessons and how humans should live their lives, what they call a Bible. No, they aren't bad little nieces and nephews," she said. "They're just human."
Thank you. That was Thomas Peacock reading from The Wolf's Trail, an Ojibwe story told by wolves, out this year, not that long ago, from Holy Cow Press in Duluth. I'm Dave, and this is Right on Radio on KFAI. Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you.
That's a nice example of you telling a story about humans through the wolves. And it's a great example of, I guess, speaking for myself, viewing humans movement through the earth and through time through through different eyes. It really sort of opens your mind up to the relationship between humans, animals, and I guess the rest of the world. Let's talk about a theme that's really powerful in here, and I'll just describe it as loss. That's how I felt it, Thomas, and I loss of tradition, loss of language, and even loss of spirit that the wolves observe in various times in the Ojibwe people. And the wolves themselves also experience a similar loss, similar losses. Is that a correct reading on my part?
Yeah, you're right on there, because you know, the whole one of the major themes in the story has to do with that, and in the fear, of course, of wolves that you know, that maybe we as Ojibwe people are losing our way, or that we've lost our way, and they're worried, of course, because what happens to us will also happen to them, because we have that parallel story, and so they're worried about that. So it is a calling, at least on my part, you know, out to, you know, other Ojibwe people, that, you know, we need to remember who we are. We can't forget who we are. And there's this intense pressure all the time, you know, just from living in contemporary society to for everyone to be alike, and we need to remember our story. So that is definitely a major theme in the book.
It's a very somber moment or chapter, I suppose, when you address these issues that you just raised, these concerns, you know, very directly in the book. And it felt very much like, you know, we were hearing from you, hearing from other Ojibwe elders about Ojibwe people today. There's a beautiful line on page 134, chapter 11. Picking up the pieces begins with the individual, one at a time, then a few more, then a community, a tribe, a nation. What did you mean by that, Thomas?
Well, what happens when a culture begins to disintegrate, a culture that had once held people together, that was once strong enough to hold people together, is no longer strong enough to buffer us from everything that, you know, we're being hit with, and people need to realize that, you know, that we need to realize as individuals that it begins with us. You know, it does. It begins with one person, and one person, and then another person. It builds like that. It's the nature of change. So,
yeah, continuing on that theme, and then we'll move along. But it's such a powerful moment, and the story builds to this sort of reckoning. One of the, I believe it's Pups, asks, why is it the humans continue to suffer so deeply while we wolves have seemingly recovered? And then part of the answer is, the difference possibly is that wolves remained wolves. It's another beautiful line. There's a lot packed into that very simple sentence and that simple phrase, wolves remained wolves. So I'll ask you the same question, Thomas. What do you want us to take from that?
Wolf culture has remained strong, you know, through everything that happened to wolves. The few remaining packs of wolves that were left, you know, hid out deep in the woods, and remain to this day very, very wary of human, any kind of human contact. And it's why, you know, I live I live in the area of the Echo Valley Wolf Pack in northern Wisconsin, where my seasonal places, and you know, it's a large pack, and I hardly ever see them. So,
wow.
You will very rarely see wolves. So wolf culture remains strong, and it's held them together. And I think I made I said something in that part of the story that, you know, what happened to us as Ojibwe is, well, wolves were able to hide deep in the bush. We Ojibwe had nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a powerful moment. Thomas, you described where you live now. Maybe we should talk a little bit about you and your career and in your story. What's the arc, the narrative arc of your story, Thomas?
I really don't know. You know, I haven't done that kind of self-analysis.
Okay. Well, how did you become a the writer that you became, and really a scholar of history, Ojibwe history and the culture?
Well, I grew up in a family where, you know, a large family, and spent a lot of time around my grandparents. And I grew up in an Indian home, and I always say that because in a native home, traditional homes, kids when a company came over, kids were always sent into another room, and we were all usually put in one room, and we never would ever interrupt adults. And I was that kid who was laying on the floor with my head stuck halfway out the door listening. And I say that, you know, I'm an avid listener. And wow. So I started listening to, you know, to adults and my grandparents tell stories, and I started remembering the stories, and I spent a lot of time doing that. And then when I became older, I went around, and I, back in the old cassette recorder days, I started interviewing elders, and
great.
In my early 20s, and
wow.
Then, you know, I don't have any kind of formal background in history or in Ojibwe history. I don't have an Indian studies or indigenous studies, anything. So I just took it on as an interest, and I started writing history, and I made the transition a few years ago over to fiction. So,
wow. Well, you're a scholar by any definition of the term, that's for sure. We all heard that story, and we're all hoping, boy, we hope you saved all those cassettes and maybe turned them into, I don't know, something else, so they'll be preserved. But I'm sure you've taken care of that. Say, Thomas, this book has so much, as I described, in a relatively small package, including on glossy paper in the front of the book, an Ojibwe Sky Star map. I'm incapable of pronouncing the Ojibwe. But it's really beautiful. It's another bonus you get from this book. Again, we're talking about The Wolf's Trail by Thomas Peacock. I know listeners can't see the map, but could you describe the Sky Star map and the significance of it for
sure.
us?
The significance of it, with the story is basically, you know, the Ojibwe people, like a lot of indigenous people, we have our own, cosmology, our own. When we look up in the sky, we see our own constellations and our own stories that go along with those constellations, and how that fits with this particular story. It's actually the title of it, the Wolf's Trail. The Wolf's Trail. If you have that constellation map in front of you,
yep.
You'll see wolf tracks going around the middle of the sky.
Yep.
That is the Wolf's Trail. It represents the ecliptic, and our ancestors figured out the ecliptic, the path of the sun around the universe, the path of the earth and the moon and all the other planets around the sun. The ecliptic tells us why there are seasons, why there are eclipses, why there are the different phases of the moon, So somehow our ancestors who had no access to what we would call Western science or astronomy had figured that out. And they called it Maingan Mikan, which translates to the wolf's trail.
Wow. And not only that, but it's a beautiful map too. I mean, it's gorgeous. We are near it. Well, we're going to stretch this out a little bit, Thomas, because we're having a good time. How does that sound? We're going to give you some extra time. Say, Thomas, on page 156 of your book, and at the beginning of every chapter, listeners, Thomas gives us a snippet of history or whatever he had in mind, maybe a story, a fable to sort of set up the next chapter. And prior to chapter 14, there's a piece of writing that Thomas, I took to be from you in your voice. Is that true?
Yeah, that's me.
You mind reading that for us?
Yeah, you're reading that. Correct. That is me.
And, okay.
It's a piece of prose that I wrote that describes my own life. So
could we have you read that for us, please?
Sure. I could. Now in the winter of my time on Earth, memory often takes me down the old road that overlooks the river that flows through Nagajawanang, the bottom of the lake, Fond du Lac Reservation in northern Minnesota. It seems the whole story of my life sings in chorus along the way of that journey in all its various cadences, octaves and ranges and moods, and in my childhood voice and that of an adult. Along the way, I recognize all the sounds and smells and bright colors in the many angles of sunlight through the trees and their seasons. And I know the dark road equally as well. This place, this road walked with parents and uncles and aunties, brothers and sisters and cousins, nephews and nieces. This place walked alone. This place journeyed. This place run upon, laughed upon, danced upon, wept upon, this life of great joy and great sorrow. The spirits of the living informed the bright sky and soothing rain in wind and waving summer flowers of this place. Bittersweet memories of loved ones who have passed on informed the moonless nights, sunless winters, and heavy air. For my life has been all of these things and more in a continuous play of light and shadow, a dance of hope and despair. My life, my life.
That was beautiful, Thomas. That was Thomas Peacock reading from The Wolf's Trail, an Ojibwe story told by wolves. That was really beautiful. And I would say, Thomas, that not only are you an historian and now a novelist, but also a poet. I mean, that was really, really beautiful. And a more succinct and... I'll use the same word again, poetic memoir, I have never read before, but that's really nice. Of the many stories in here, one is, you know, particularly stands out, I think, and that's the story about little boy. Do you want to tell us about that and the significance of little boy, that story, for your overarching story?
Sure. This is the one of the stories that I really hesitated whether I should tell that part of the story, because we Ojibwe have one of our prophecies, one of the teachings is that you know, when our culture became very heavily influenced by Western culture, our spiritual people and leaders took all our teachings, our sacred teachings that were written on bark tablets, and they put them in an ironwood log and sealed it, and they put it into a cave somewhere. And so that particular chapter is built around that. The little boy you might think of in terms of more symbolic. There could be a little boy, and it could be a little boy, but little boy could also represent our spiritual practice, because in our ceremonies, and little boy represents the water drum.
Nice. So before we wrap up here, Thomas, what are you going to be working on next?
Well, I'm always working on something, and I have a pile of rejection manuscripts. This is about as tall as I am, so I'm popping up other stories. How's that?
There you go. Well, you know, it's good to hear that you're human, and like the rest of us, that's wonderful. I tell you, Thomas, it's been an honor and a privilege to talk with you. It's Thomas Peacock. The book is The Wolf's Trail, an Ojibwe story told by wolves. You can get it wherever books are sold. I'm pretty sure about that. Thank you so much, Thomas. It's just been a treat.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, wish you all the best. And with that, Josh, we'll turn it back to you in the studio.
I am here as Juan Manuel Munoz. He's a physician, political scientist, futurist, business administrator, musician, and social activist in the areas of human rights, pacifism, and a movement towards a sustainable environment. From primates to politicians, is a fascinating journey between the animal side of the human species and politicians. It explores the reasons for many human behaviors based on the evolution of species and the resources necessary for life. Welcome to Right on Radio, Juan.
Thank you for the interview.
So I want to ask you initially, so you're a vision scientist. How does one become an ophthalmologist and political scientist?
Yes, in medical school, we're taught to care about people's health. Mm-hmm. And health is more than the absence of disease. It's a complete state of well-being, of a biological, social, psychological, and even spiritual well-being. All in political sciences, it gave me a better understanding of how to achieve that social well-being.
You talk about in the book how binocular vision was an important factor in the expansion of brain structures and increasing our brain size. How did binocular vision allow for expanded brain structures?
Yes, binocular vision is a complex process. Every time a complex process appears in the human brain, then new structures, new pathways are needed to make it more efficient. Binocular vision is not just a biological evolutionary advantage. It's also a process that has improved the human brain.
The process you're referring to is natural selection, and I want to talk about that for a little bit. While natural selection is significant, I was surprised to learn from this book that it's, despite how roundly supported different evidence has been out there for it, it's one of the theories most widely accepted by scientists, but it's also the one that doesn't get talked about as much in the public. Why don't we hear that enough in the public sphere?
Yeah, Josh, it is a very interesting question. It seems like there's something missing between the scientific world and common people. The communication is not clear and it's not enough. In fact, every day you can see more conspiracy theories and more pseudoscience rather than more science among common people.
Can you explain for our listening audience, I did not realize this, but there are two different schools of thought when it comes to primatology, or two different branches. There's what's Western primatology, which I refer to as, from my own notes, like a psychological anthropocentrism, and Japanese primatology, which is more sociological and based off of primates and their natural element.
Yes, well, both of them started a few years after World War II. In Japan, they started observing monkeys in their natural environment. They just observe what goes on in nature. And in Western primatology, they have studied the same primates, but in lab control conditions. So it allowed the scientists to have experiments on them.
Yes. You mentioned a small detail that I think is worth an analysis in itself. Why are so many primatologists mostly women and political scientists men?
It's a good question. I don't have an answer for that, Josh.
Oh.
I don't want to think that there is an issue of gender inequality. Mm. In fact, we have very good primatologists that are male, and we have very good political scientists that are women. But I don't know why the distribution is different for one branch of science and the other.
Humans have five dimensions to our personalities of extroversion, conscientiousness, openness, neuroticism, and agreeableness. What dimensions of personality have been observed in primates outside of humans?
Okay, the most studied of the primates outside humans are chimpanzees. And they have three of the dimensions we have. They have agreeableness, extroversion, and they also have openness, okay? But the other two dimensions we have as human beings are replacing them by three other dimensions. The dimension of neuroticism in humans might be equivalent to a dimension of reactiveness in chimpanzees, as well as the consciousness dimension in human beings is replaced in chimpanzees by two dimensions. One of them is about being methodic, and the other is about being dominant.
You say in the book that anthropocentric mentality robs us of learning about the possibility of learning about ourselves and understand the relationship between our biology and politics. How so?
Okay, if we understand mankind, human beings, just as something different from the rest of nature, that robs of the opportunity to study human beings as part of the rest of the animals. As if we understand human beings as part of an evolution, as part of a nature, that gives us the opportunity to learn from other species, from other societies, and other animals, and to extrapolate that knowledge to understand better our societies. Hmm.
Politics, you talk about, isn't an exclusive activity for humans. Animals have their own organizational structures for organizing their societies. How can we understand human societies better through the study of animal societies?
Okay, human societies are not isolated. As I told you before, human societies are part of a long process of evolution along millions of years. And other species also have issues that we are discussing nowadays before the US election. For example, migration. You know, if we study monkeys, we can see some patterns of migration and the reaction of them when they have migrants out and in their groups. Mm-hmm. Understanding better those problems in other species give us more elements to understand the problem in human societies, and also give us the opportunity to give better solutions to the problems we have.
Yeah. In a book about animals and politics, a question that has only gained more relevance you address directly: are homosexual interactions natural?
They are natural. They are natural. They are very common in different species. At least 10 to 20% of different species of animals have homosexuals. In humans, homosexuality is also natural. Okay, we have to make the difference between natural and normal. We understand normality as how common it is, okay? Mm-hmm. Maybe most of the individuals are not homosexual, okay? That makes homosexuality something not normal. But it's natural. It's natural, it's part of our species, it's part of the animal kingdom.
I was wondering if you could explain at a greater length this notion of theory of mind, stating leadership is nothing more than the product of asymmetric information management among individuals in a group trying to obtain social advantage. What does that really mean?
In primitive animals, leadership is just understood in terms of food and reproduction, okay? And the leader guides the rest of the group. In the case of humans, we are more complex animals. In order to guide a group, we have to have a better knowledge of the environment and a better knowledge of ourselves and of each individual in the group. Every time you have an asymmetrical distribution of knowledge, the one with more knowledge about the environment and of the group and individual knowledge of each of the members of the group, that person will have an advantage to become a leader within the group.
So you talk a little bit how primates have a limitation for their cognitive ability to be able to maintain in interpreting and understanding populations. Is there a limit for human populations that can exceed their cognitive ability?
Pardon?
Is there a limit for human populations that can exceed their cognitive ability for individuals? The number I'm thinking of which I was going to ask about, you didn't directly mention the book, is I think it's around 250 people we can maintain social interactions or have contact with people. And there's a point, if you exceed that amount, it's difficult for us to maintain and be able to process that. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit and for primates.
Yes, you know, our species just have around 60,000 years on Earth, okay? But to have an important change in our genes to adapt to a new situation, we need around 50,000 years. So our genes are still the genes of small groups of hunters and gatherers. Especially after the development of agriculture, we have had increasing number of individuals in our societies. To reach that a number of individuals in a society, we needed communication, okay, especially speech. So we have to socialize more to have a more complex society of more individuals.
And based on you talked about a few comparative studies in the book on the discussion of socialization, it demonstrated that it's crucial to the enlargement of the human brain. If we keep increasing our lines of communication, would this increase our need for more neural connections? And if that's the case, then does that mean humans are getting smarter through social media?
That is a very good question, George. That is a very good question. We can have that extrapolation. We can say something like that. Like, okay, we're having more communication that will lead us to more complex societies, and then we will need better connected brains and maybe bigger brains. Mm-hmm. Well, we cannot play Nostradamus in this case. Social media has just between 1 and 2 decades with us, and we have to continue observing what changes occur in our brain. In fact, in the last decade, we have been observing that the use of social media increases some mental diseases, some eye diseases, but we don't know in the future what will we find in our brain as a whole.
On the topic of the future, my last question for you, and perhaps the most difficult one, is you have a really good line in the book on the discussion of politics. You said politics remains an art far from being able to decipher. And evolutionary politics, I think, is an example of how it's become more interdisciplinary in the realm of political science. What other fields of study do you think will be integrated in political science in the future based off more research and more understanding?
Okay, I will go back to one of the first questions. Do you remember I told you there's something missing between scientific knowledge and common people? Well, there's also something missing between scientific disciplines. And maybe in the future, we won't see the development of something specific to understand more politics. maybe what we will see is a better connection between different branches of sciences, different branches of knowledge, so we can integrate them to have a better understanding of them as a whole. For example, in political sciences, they didn't consider, for example, primatology. Mm. And maybe they also don't consider medicine, okay? Mm. Neurosciences. But all those branches of sciences are already running, are already generating new knowledge that can just be integrated in what we're studying.
I really hope so.
indeed, neurosciences will be the next boom in political sciences. But I'm not sure that it will be that easy for us to understand the human brain. You know, we're trying to understand the human brain for centuries.
That is it. We are out of time, but you've been listening to my interview with Juan Manuel Munoz about his new book, From Primates to Politicians. Juan, thanks so much for being here on the show with us.
Thank you very much, George.
You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Old.
And I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Juan Manuel Munoz and Thomas D. Peacock, plus our listeners who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right On Radio at kfai.org/program/Right On Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere podcasts can be found.